Hello, my name is Cindy, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank you for coming out to hear my story. It's a privilege and a gift of this program, and I'm not saying I want to be up here, but it's a duty, and it's a gift that I was given so freely when I walked through these doors almost 2 years ago. My sobriety date is March the 5th. 2017. So I'm supposed to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. So with that, I'll start my story. My mind's a little all over the place, so forgive me if I digress. I was born in St. Petersburg, Florida in the late 60s, really late, almost 70s. To a mother who was not equipped to be a mother and to a father who didn't want to be one. So, I was ceremoniously adopted by my maternal grandparents, as an infant, and I was raised as their child. As a result of that, my mother and all of her siblings became my siblings. I was promptly deposited in a small town, in central Florida on a working farm. My mother was a dietitian and my father was a builder and a farmer. I will say that my mother was the, if there ever was a person on earth that I wanted to be like, it would be her, because she had such grace and love. I never heard her say a bad word about anybody, especially my father, who was an alcoholic. He was sober 27 years when he passed away, but he was definitely, we call him dry drunks now, but he definitely had all of the isms, and he was mean and mean-spirited, and he ruled our house with an iron thumb. So there was a lot of fear while I was growing up in that environment, and my mother, God love her, stood between me and him and any of the other children, my siblings. So she was truly a wonderful woman and someone I'd love to be like. But we lived on a compound, not a cult compound, but a family compound. So we had a big house, and then we had all of the siblings, because they were older than me, obviously. And they had little houses all around. So we had a compound there, and it was, we called it the big house. So we lived in the big house, and then, you know, it was typical for us. We had breakfast, lunch, and dinner at my house, at the big house. And so it was a village. I really lived in a village growing up, and all my childhood wasn't completely horrible, but it was definitely wrought with fear. It was definitely wrought with fear and being less than. So I went to private school most of my childhood. So I had Bible for an hour a day, every day. I was in church every time the door opened. But I never really knew God till I got to AA. My understanding of God was hellfire and brimstone kind of God. So, you know, you learned your Bible verses, you did the right thing, and if you did that, then you wouldn't get hit, or you wouldn't get yelled at, or whatever. So that was kind of the God that I grew up with. I excelled in school, but I think I excelled in school because I was afraid not to. I was afraid not to. There was that fear, and even though I excelled in school, straight A's, because I went to a private school and you had to make a B or you had to go back. So I think that fear made me excel in school. When I was about 9 or 10, I remember I was at daycare. I didn't have to go to daycare, but I went there because my whole life, from the time I can remember, all I wanted was a child. That's all I wanted. I wanted to play with children. I wanted to be around children. I wanted children. And so I was allowed to go and, you know, play with the children at daycare. I was 9 or 10 or whatever. And I remember when I was 9 or 10, one of the deacon's wives in the daycare told me, she said, well, I guess your mom and dad told you that you were adopted and your mother is really your sister. And that was at 9 or 10. And I was like, you know, to tell a child that. So I asked my mother, and she said, you're our child. You're our child. So it wasn't a lie, but it really wasn't the truth either. And then I asked my mother, my biological mother, and she said, no, I'm not your mother. You know, so that was a lie. So from that point on, I think I knew something was off. Like, I knew when she came, I cried when she left. I knew that she bought me all of everything that I had. I had things in excess. And I think that was her guilt, trying to shower me with, you know, all of these things, because she knew that the environment I was in was not healthy. It wasn't healthy, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't what you should do, I think. And I think she knew that. So, my life was fairly uneventful. I mean, I had an okay childhood, aside from the fear and never feeling like, you know, walking around on eggshells. But when I was, you know, I still did the people pleasing. I still had the fear. I had the manipulation. I had that down pat by the time I was 12. And I think it was a survival mechanism. But for the most part, it was okay. I mean, I didn't get beat or anything like that. But it was, when I was 9 or 10 or 11 maybe, it was understood. My father was, he had not taken a drink in 27 years when he died. But he was sick. He smoked. He destroyed his life. He destroyed his body with alcohol. And so it was understood in our family that he was going to die. So we were prepared, right? I was prepared. And my mother, who was self-sacrificing and did everything for her family and was just this pillar, we were going to do things for her when Daddy died. We weren't going to have to go back, and she wasn't going to have to work in the farm, and she wasn't going to have to do all of these things that she was required to do to keep Daddy happy. And then she died. She died on September 14, 1981. I was 15. And she was the only source of constant love that I had, you know, so it was not supposed to go that way. What I didn't understand. So my home, that destroyed our family, and everybody, like, nobody came to the big house except for me. It was me and my father, and he was so broken. He was so broken. All he wanted to do was die, and he prayed to die every day. And I went to school, and I'd come home, and I'd watch him pray to die, and he'd tell me that I want to die, I don't want to be here, because that happens sometimes when you're with someone for that long. And my siblings just kind of checked out, deuces, see you later. And so that was devastating for me. And a year and a half later, my father died. A year and a half to the day. He died, and that was, you know, I felt I didn't want him to die because I loved him. But at the same time, he was mean, and he was making my life miserable. So I thought, yeah, okay, die, you know. And so that's a guilt that I still carry around today, because he did, you know. And then my life really, really took off. You know, that was when I started getting fear and worse fear and bitterness and hopelessness and my mind trying to get out of that space. And we didn't have alcohol in the house. I didn't know what alcohol was because he was an alcoholic. So I switched from private school to public school at this point, when I was about 16, and I discovered my first addiction, which was men, boys. I wanted out of the pain that I was in. as I said, my siblings, including my mother, had been like, okay, like, they just wanted me to go away, and I was 16 years old. So, I'd seen somebody, and I said, well, I guess I'm going to pick him. And so I picked him, and I made him marry me. He didn't want to. He didn't come willingly, but I was good at manipulation. And so, I picked him, and that was it. We were oil and water from the very beginning. I didn't love him. He didn't love me. He was my first drug of choice, really, because I wanted out of where I was, and he was something else for me to focus on. And, you know, at this point, I drank one time, I think, Hunch Punch, that Everclear with the watermelon and all of that, and you drink it. It made me sick. And I really, really didn't like it. So I didn't really, the drinking didn't really hit me at that point. But I knew this. I wanted children. In order to have children, you have to have a husband. So that was my plan. I was going to leave with him, and he was in the Navy, and I was going to leave with him and go have children, and everything would be great, and then I could have someone else to fill that hole that I had within me. So I was diagnosed with endometriosis shortly after, and so it was not possible at that time to get pregnant, so I made that my newest obsession. So, you know, you do lots of things. You do your ovulation, and you go get steroid shots and Lupron shots and, you know, all of these things. So I did that. Still, I did not conceive. We traveled around from Florida to Illinois to Connecticut, California, South Carolina. 2 years we did that. We did that for 2 years. And in California, I did a little bit of drugs, but I left there and gave them up. They didn't really do anything for me. I still wanted to have a child. And so I got to South Carolina, and he was an absentee husband. He went to sea 3 months. He was in 3 months. So I was selling junk or promotional items, and I met my soon-to-be, well, my future second husband. He was someone to pay me attention, because I had to have that, right? Yeah, I couldn't get enough attention. I had to have that attention. And so my husband was out to sea, and I was seeing this other guy, my second husband. He wasn't my husband yet, but I really enjoyed that. And this is when I was really introduced to alcohol, because he was 18 years my senior, and he had a lot of money, and he had a lot of, you know, he was highly educated, and we went to a lot of parties. We traveled a lot. We had, and alcohol was always part of it. And then's when I got my first taste of what alcohol could do for me. And I liked it a little bit, because I got the fruity drinks, you know. I didn't have that nasty gasoline type of drink. So I started using alcohol and enjoyed the effects of it. At this point, between the 18 to 25, I decided that I was going to look up my biological father. Whatever possessed me to do that, I have no idea. It was completely against my biological mother's wishes. She's like, no, don't do that. But I did, and I was living in South Carolina at the time. My husband was out to sea. I was seeing another man, and I traveled to Georgia to meet my father. And one of the first things he said to me, when I met him, I asked him, I said, so how come he wasn't married? And he was an attractive man. He looked like Sean Connery. And I asked him, I said, how come you never married, you know, after my mom? And he looked at me and he said, because there's no one on this earth that I love more than myself. That should have given me a little a little clue, but it didn't, you know, because I'm kind of thick like that. But it did not go well. It did not go well with my father. That was the worst thing I've ever done. But I can say this. I was able at that point to look back on my life and know that the way God had his hand in the way I was raised. Because, as I stated earlier, my husband was out to sea, I was seeing another man, and then I met my father. Well, I all of a sudden, and that was in October, in November, I became pregnant. And I had to terminate the pregnancy. The childhood that I had may not have been perfect, but it was probably a hell of a lot better than it would have been had it turned out differently. So I got divorced. My first husband could not hang with my craziness, and I wanted my cake and I wanted to eat it too. I wanted my guy on the side and then I wanted my husband so I could have another child, right? I wanted a child to make sure it was, you know, his child. But that didn't work out. So when I was 25 or 26, I got divorced from my first husband, and that devastated me because I still loved him. But I don't think it was love. I think it was an addiction. When he was happy, I was happy. When he was sad, I was sad. He was truly, like a drug for me. But then when I divorced him, I was still seeing my second husband, and I married him in 1995 when I was 29. And I still, all I really, really wanted was to get pregnant. That's all. And so I kept going and doing all of these things and trying to get pregnant and trying to get pregnant and trying to get pregnant. I had some success. I was working for a mid-sized property management firm, making decent money. He made decent money. My mother, my biological mother, was living with us. And she did our whole marriage, which was kind of odd, but I turned into the mother. I was the mother, so I took care of her. I still take care of her today. So, and I don't have any ill feelings about it, but it's a lot for a child to go from that to, and then take care of your mother. But my husband took care of my mother, myself, and my brother, who was mentally incapable. He was always mentally incapable from the time he was a child. He had the mind of a 13-year-old, and he was about 15 years older than me. So my husband, my second husband, took care of all of that and this crazy. So he was not perfect by any means, and our marriage was not perfect by any means, but he did the best he could with what he had. And so I was still I was still drinking and all of that, but it wasn't, the wheels hadn't fallen off yet. But when I was 35, I had to have a complete and total hysterectomy and several other operations because I was close to dying. I let it go that long trying to have a child, and finally it's like you've got to have this done. And so it was emergency. It was an emergency situation. So I had a complete and total hysterectomy, and there goes my dreams, right? What am I? What am I if I'm not a mother? And I was never going to be a mother. And I knew that. So my drinking picked up a little bit then. That's when I started drinking every night. And my husband was all too happy to whatever I wanted, because that's one thing he did. Whatever I wanted. He spoiled me rotten. I didn't have to do anything. I just asked and poof, it appeared. And looking back on it now, he would have probably loved me to death, because the doctors told him to stop drinking. He stopped drinking. He may have been a heavy drinker. Me? No. Oh, you need a gallon? Okay, I'll go get it. kind of thing. You know, it was definitely, and I didn't think I had a problem. You know, I just knew that it made me feel better. And then's when I started drinking, into blackout status. We purchased a boat, and every weekend we had a boat dock down on Lake Altoona, and every weekend we'd go down there and get, I don't know how we lived through those years, because, you know, you're drunk, you're on the boat, you're doing things that, like, you're driving all over the boat skiing with, you know, you're drunk. So, we did that for a number of years, and there was no consequences. You know, I kept a job. I excelled at my job. I made good money. I made a lot of money. And so did he. So I didn't really have any consequences. Then in 2006, I got my first DUI in, Marietta. I wasn't out at a bar. I was in bed asleep, blacked out, and I got up, got in my car, drove 7 miles down Blackacre Trail Road all the way up to the Steak and Shake because I wanted a turtle milkshake and a double cheeseburger. I don't remember any of it, but I got there in a total blackout. The first thing I remember was waking up to a cop saying, "Put your cigarette out." And I'm like, you know, I got real aggressive. I flicked my cigarette at him. He burned his cheek. That did not turn out well. Needless to say, I ended up in jail. yeah, in the drunk tank in Cobb County. And I will say that Cobb County's kind of nice. Not like Fulton, which happens later. But, yeah, so lots of money and time later, like, I didn't think I had a problem. You pay for the attorney, you go do your little, you know, you pay somebody to do your little community service or you do whatever. And it was, I didn't think I had a problem. I would go to my classes or go do my community service, come home and drink. Cause that's, you know, that's what I did. And I still didn't think I had a problem. And nobody told me I had a problem. Not even my mother. I had to tell the company that I was working for, which was a mid-sized property management firm. I had 30 or 26 properties at the time, higher-end condos. We managed condos all throughout the city. And I had to tell my boss, I got a DUI. Of course, I lied when I called in. No, just tell her I'm sick. And then I had to tell her. I had to go in and tell her I had a DUI. And you know what her response was? Oh, that's no problem. Everybody gets DUIs. And that's how I looked at it. Oh, okay. So yeah, you just do your little thing, and if you need this or you need, you know, whatever you need to do, it's fine. So still, I thought, here you go, it's no problem. I continue to drink. So around 2009, I think, I tried to look up my mugshot and find out when it was, but I couldn't. Didn't work out for me. I thought you can plug your name in, it just pops up. It's not magic like that. So I believe, to the best of my recollection, it was 2009. I got my second DUI, and that one was a little bit more difficult to get out of. That was in Fulton County. The VP and myself started drinking at South City Kitchen downtown, or midtown. At about 12 o'clock, we just had a couple bottles of wine, maybe three, I don't know, it was just two of us. And then somehow we ended up down in Little Five Points. Yeah. And I wasn't familiar with that area or whatever. And, yeah, I ended up this time with, drunk and disorderly conduct. I think I tried to hit one of them. Hit and run. DUI, of course. This time I lost my license. And I had jail time in Fulton County. I had to do classes. They didn't have drug court as strict as they have it now, but it was not good. But I would go to those classes, and I would drink vodka before I went to the classes, stand in there, and act like, oh, yeah, I'm sober, like they didn't know, and then go home and drink some more until I passed out, because that's what I did. And I still didn't have a problem. No one has. I didn't think I had a problem. So I lost my license for 6 months on that. Luckily, I had left the company I was working for on the first DUI, and I was purchasing a company. I'd put down a little bit of money on that company. And I got fired from that company. And I lost that little bit of money I put down. And I'll never forget my husband standing there, "For God's sake, honey, how the hell did you get fired? You're buying it." Well, when you can't take care of your 15 clients and you got people calling in because you're drunk, because, you know, drinking's required when you do these things, right? You have parties and you have to buy the wine and you have to do the parties and all of that stuff. And so when you're drinking at the parties and you're acting like you're drunk, because you are, it's a problem. So, yeah, that kind of was not good. So I was kind of in between jobs when on February of 2013, my life changed once again when my husband passed. He passed February the 19th of 2013. We had been married 18 years. And he did everything for me. Like, I worked and I made a good living, and I was, for the most part, I was high functioning, if that's even possible. I mean, I think I was high functioning because I hid everything really well, right? And people liked me because I could spin it that way. So, oh yeah, she can handle it. So, I had no idea how to take care of my mother. I had no idea everything he did. I didn't have to shop. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't pay bills. I didn't manage the money. I did nothing. All I did was manage the properties and come home and drink and do what I wanted to do. I shopped when I wanted to shop. I did what I wanted to do. And looking back on it, I think he knew, he was dying. He started getting sick in October, and he was trying to tell me, like, okay, you got to do this and you got to, you know, this, look at this. And I'm like, what are you telling me that for? I don't even care. Like, get out of my face. I had no idea how to take care of myself. All I had any idea how to do was drink. And that's the truth. And shop and people, you know, I could do any of those things, you know? But I couldn't, like, take care of myself. And I was completely devastated and lost when he passed. I mean, my water was getting cut off. I was making decent money. I could go buy whatever I wanted to buy, but I couldn't pay my water. I was standing in, like, New Jersey or somewhere with, like, 15 owners around. And my mom's calling me on the phone, "Hey, they're cutting the water off." I'm like, oh, my God. So I'm standing there managing these multi-million dollar properties, and my water's getting cut off. It's fine. They loved me. They never said a word about it. But that's pretty sad when you don't pay your water bill. I was traveling a lot with my job, and when I traveled, I drank. You know, I'd go to the hotel room and drink, and I would answer emails, and I would do. It's a wonder I'm not dead. It's really a wonder I'm not dead. I would go and knock on. I think I was going to my hotel room, and I'd be in somebody else's hotel room, or I'd go to a different hotel altogether because, you know, they're right there on the strip. Oh, wait, am I at the Hilton or the Best Western? I don't remember. It was not good. All during that time, I was doing prescription drugs. I apologize, drugs are a part of my story. I was doing prescription drugs. I was drinking. I was peopling. And by peopling, I mean I was going out and screwing anything that would screw me. And it wasn't for anything but, attention. You know, I wanted that attention. I wanted somebody to save me is what I did. I wanted somebody to save me. So I couldn't pay my bills, and I was like, oh, holy crap, what am I going to do? So I ended up, I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's this local nonprofit, and it's called Papa's Pantry. They would help me do a budget. So I went in to do a budget with Faith, was her name, sweet lady. And so she would hold me accountable and yell at me for buying 22, 32-ounce Cokes on my debit card in a week or whatever. So she taught me. And then, and you know, I had to get food from there to catch back up. I had to get food. I had to get food from a food pantry, and I was making decent money. I mean, that's how far down I had slid. And so there was one thing. I tried to quit drinking at this point. I tried to. And I had a little nephew. They were my great-nephew and great-niece, and their parents would let me watch them on the weekends, right? And I think they were the only thing in the beginning that kept me alive. So I would hold on to a little bit of sobriety, a little bit, like, you know, a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever. But the one rule I had was I would never drink when I had them. I would never drink when I had those children. And their parents came to get them. Now, the children were never in danger because my mother would have killed me if I'd hurt them. She was right there the whole time going. So, but their parents came and got them one day, and I woke up and I didn't remember. I didn't remember them picking them up. So that next day I had an appointment with Faith, and I was pretty much done at that point. So I blurted out, "I'm an alcoholic." And she's like, and she's a preacher's child who's never, what is that? But she had someone that she knew, and she said, "Well, I have someone that I want to give your number to, and let her call you." And I said, "Okay, fine." So the next day, she called me. She was an alcoholic. And she worked at Papa's, but every time I came in, which was every flipping week, sometimes twice a week when I really messed up my budget. But she called me, and I think I threw up on her. Like, she called me, and it was probably more than she bargained for. But she listened to me. And looking back on it now, because I didn't have relationships. I had relationships with no one. I didn't care about anyone but myself and my drinking, my alcohol. That's what I cared about, alcohol and me. And anybody else could, you know, just leave me alone. So she actually listened to what I had to say, you know. And I would call her at night drunk, and then I would go to meetings, and she would listen to me. And she'd say, "Well, I'm going to have coffee at the Howell place. You want to come have coffee?" And so I did. And I always say that she loved me until I could love myself, because I didn't. I didn't love myself. I didn't know how. I didn't know how to love myself. So that's where I got sober. I was drunk on March the 4th, 2017. And she not only extended her invitation to have coffee at the Howell place, she extended her home, she extended her time with her family to me. She actually got me to come to this church here. And on March 4th, 2017 was a Saturday night. I was drunk, of course, blacked out. But I got up on the 5th and I came here to this church with her. And the sermon was given by an alcoholic addict, and it was a complete program. It was that's where I had my spiritual awakening, because it was the most God showed up, you know, not the God that I grew up with, a God that made all of these things possible for these people. I was so touched. I went home and I cried myself to sleep. And that night I said to God, either take me or cure me. And that's basically what I said. Either I want to die, because I did want to die at that point. I didn't want to live. I said, either take me or cure me. And I woke up on March the 6th and I picked up my white chip. I hadn't taken a drink. And I told my mom, who was after me the whole time, "Please stop drinking. Please stop drinking. You're killing yourself." So I remember getting up and telling her, I'm not going to drink anymore. That woman knew where all my bottles were. I was like, did I hide that there? Yes, you did. She was up on the ladder getting them out. It was hilarious. And she went and poured everything out. And I haven't had a drink since. But that was my moment of clarity. That was my first step, right? That was the moment when I knew that what I was doing wasn't working. And I also knew that these people they were happy, right? They were happy they made it through. They had some of the stories that I heard that day were a lot worse than where I had been, you know? So I realized that maybe I could be happy. So I haven't had a mind-altering drug or a drink since March the 3rd, 2017. And I think I was on a pink cloud for a minute. Well, at least for the first 7 months, which is that elusive 9-month chip. I remember my sister pissed me off really bad, and it took me 2.2 seconds. When I was about 7 or 8 months sober, it took me 2.2 seconds to get in my head, I'm going to go to my bank, I'm going to overdraw my account, I'm going to stop and get 3 boxes of wine because I wanted to have enough. Then I was going to stop at this bar and do shots, and this bar and do shots in order to get home, right? Because they were close to the house. And when I got in my car, that pause, you hear that pause, right? That pause. I had that pause, that moment of, oh, wait, before I put my key in my ignition, why don't I go to the Howe place? So it just so happens the day that I was going to do this, there was like a biker meeting or something. It was all men. I'm standing up there going, holy heck, what is going on? And they're all knocking on, are you okay? I mean, ugly cries, not everywhere. It was horrible. Are you okay? I'm like, leave me alone. So I pulled out. Like, I had so many women, and that I never had women friends because I didn't like them and they didn't like me, and that was just fine. But I had so many women friends from the Howe place, right? I think I called 25 people. I ended up messaging someone on Facebook, and she's like, here, I'm here. Where do you want to meet? Let's go to Dunkin' Donuts. So Mary G met me at Dunkin' Donuts and talked through it. And, you know, I don't know what it was, but that was my meltdown. And I didn't really, like, I didn't know at that time that it was God that did that. Right? Because I'm still 5 years to pick up your marbles, 5 years to, you know, I barely had a clear thought at that point at 6 months. Like, it was like a radio coming in and out. Oh, wait, you know, kind of thing. So I didn't know it was God at that time, but it was. And my second year of sobriety has been very humbling, which is where I think the change happens. For me, that's where it happened. For me, the change happened when I quit my job making good money because I couldn't do the job because I couldn't stay sober, and I knew that. I knew I couldn't stay sober. So I quit. What I did was I called the temp agency and said, hey, can I work? I never went without a job, but I went from having a good job to having a temp job. So I was a temp at 40 something. And that was very humbling. And then a sister in the program, what I did was they told me, I got a sponsor. And she told me what to do. All of y'all told me what to do because I didn't know what to do. I mean, all I knew how to do was drink. And so, you do this, you go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I think I stayed at the Howe place for like, I don't know, 6 days solid. They were playing Bill W. there. And they were bringing food in. I don't remember exactly when that was, but I stayed there the whole day and went to every meeting there was, even the men's. They let me sit in the men's too. They didn't kick me out. They're like, yeah, just sit back there and don't say nothing. I think one of the old timers said, just sit back there, don't say a word. You'll be all right. Just listen. Put the cotton, what was it, take the cotton out of your ears, put them in your mouth. That's exactly what they said. I got a sponsor, and one of my sisters in the program, I was in real estate and property management my whole life. I've sold real estate, I've managed real estate, I've bought real estate, I've asset managed, all of that. And one of the sisters in the program, I was working temp, making nothing and having no insurance. And she's like, hey, they're hiring in Cartersville. I was like, Cartersville? Where's that? And it's leasing. I was like, leasing? I don't lease. I don't do that. So, but I went, right, because it was a steady job and I didn't have to run all over Atlanta. And she just told me about it, right? And that's another one of the beauties of this program and the gifts that we get, you know. She didn't get the job for me. She sent me there. And I think the lesson in humility for me was when I started working there, I remember calling my sponsor going, oh, these people don't do it right. I have got to get out of here. They do not do this right. They do not do that right. And I remember her on the phone with me going, please make a gratitude list and call me back. Click. And then, of course, I was like, you know, so. And then she would say, you know, just stay where you're at. Be still, you know. And I didn't understand that either. I wasn't sober enough to understand that pause, that I didn't get it. But I stayed there because she told me to, and God only knows I couldn't make a decision. You know, I had to call, what kind of cream do I put in my coffee? And it's funny, but it's true. I mean, I did. I had to call her every time I turned around. But she was, you know, a lot of times, like I said, she'd be like, no, make a gratitude list. No, turn around, shut up. So anyway, sorry. In sobriety, in the second year, I also had to give up my place and move in with my family. Five people in a 1,500 square foot house. I've never, ever in my life and in my years, like 30, 40 years, ever had to do that. Ever. And so that was very, very humbling. And I thought it was humiliating, right? But it really wasn't, because I had an amends to make to my family because they helped me when my husband died, right? I didn't have any money. I had no idea how to get the money. I had no idea how to do anything. So they did step up, and I'm making a living amends to them. But that was very, very humbling to me. So in my second year of sobriety, I suffered two heart attacks. My mother was in the hospital. Her blood pressure bottomed out. I almost lost her. I know, don't laugh, but I lost both of my fur babies, and they were my children, you know, this in my second year. So I've had some pretty tough stuff in the second year, but I haven't taken a drink. And the only reason I haven't taken a drink is because of you people, you know, the fellowship. God, number one, the God of my understanding. I have to pray every day, and I have to hit my knees. It makes a difference when you hit your knees. It makes a difference. And sometimes I have to pray 50 times a day. Trying to find that pause, that stillness. And I'm learning, I said I'm learning to meditate. This doesn't do well with meditation, but I mean, like, I'm up to a minute, maybe, like 45 seconds, which is really good. But I know you have to get a sponsor, and that's someone who's sober and who's been sober longer than you. It's always helpful. You can relate to them. You have access to them. You can confide in them. And you can really tell them your jacked up stuff. You know, we share in a general way. We share in a general way in here, but a sponsor really can get down in the nitty gritty and dig it out. And that's what Stephanie's done. That's what Katie's done. I mean, she's dug it out. Like, it helps. And I call them my sober sisters. So, And then you have to do service. And like I said, it wasn't my choice. Chance called me up and said, hey, or he met me, we were at another meeting, and I was like, sure, no problem. I'm impetuous like that. Oh yeah. And then I thought about it, like, it wasn't like 3 days later, I'm like, Katie, here's the thing. I don't really want to do it. Okay. I don't want to stand up here and do this because you're vulnerable. I've spoken in front of crowds before, and she's like, well, here's the thing. Cindy, you really have to. That's the gift of the program. Okay. When you're asked to do something in AA, you do it. I've made coffee. I've put tennis balls all over several times at the Howe place. Pulled them off, put them on, cut them. I've done whatever is asked of me to do. And for me, that's the only way for me now, today, the only way I'm staying sober is getting outside of myself, right? And relying on the people that love me. Because they truly, everyone in AA loved me until I could love myself. And I know I've got such a long way to go. Y'all might hear me next year or 3 years from now be like, that was nothing. That story was not anything. What did she change lives or something? But yeah. And then you got to work the steps continuously, because I forgot about the action part. Like, wait a minute, I'm sober. Thanks. See you later. It doesn't work that way. You've got to actually do the things that you say you're going to do. The 10th step every night. I still have a hard time with that one, but I'm getting better. And you don't drink. And the gratitude list and the journaling has saved my ass many times. Many, many times. And I wanted to read this, and I forgot my... Can I walk away, Damon?
What do you need?
I just need my phone. Yes. I want to read this and then I'm done. Thank you so much for listening to my craziness. This is not AA approved literature, but it spoke to my soul. I read it sometimes once a day, sometimes twice a day. But it helps me and it kind of sums up me. I went crazy to find sanity. I lied to myself and everyone else to see the truth. I walked through hell to understand heaven. I experienced death to feel life. Addiction could have been my demise, a horrific and lonely end. Instead, it brought me to a new beautiful beginning. The madness tore open my soul and introduced my spirit to life. So, thank you so much for letting me share.